Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's June 5th, 2020 program, What We Know and What We Don't About Employment Post-Coronavirus. This is the 34th program of our 2019-20 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I am the City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, our mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. And Lane Community College. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. It provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. I would also like to acknowledge the generous support from the City of Eugene and from Lane County. Turning to today's program, Oregon's legislature raised the minimum wage in 2016 and provided for a series of increases through the year 2022. In December of 2019, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, OCPP, released a report describing the characteristics of Oregon's minimum wage workers at that time and projecting changes as the wage increased. 6 months ago, neither the legislature nor OCPP could have taken into account the effects of a pandemic on the most vulnerable sector of full-time workers. The program today will portray the current overall employment situation in Oregon and provide details about the impact of the pandemic on a few key sectors. We have four speakers for today's program. Audrey Meckling is the first Chuck Sheketoff Public Policy Fellow at OCPP. She grew up in rural southwestern Oregon and has worked as a policy aide and a campaign manager. She earned a BA in politics at Willamette University and a master's degree in public administration at the University of Southern California. Ira Cuello Martinez is the community advocacy coordinator at VAWS, a workers' rights education program in Portland. VAWS works with older adults, seniors, immigrants and refugees, houseless, and those living with chronic illnesses. Ira earned a BA at Willamette University and was an organizer for PICUN. Margarita Sandoval is a domestic worker in Portland, Oregon. She has been affiliated with the National Domestic Workers Alliance and is an organizer with the YWCA of Greater Portland, which has the mission of empowering women and eliminating racism. Joel Eboa is the coalition manager for CAUSA, an organization working to improve the lives of Latinx and other immigrants and their families in Oregon through advocacy, coalition building, leadership development, and civic engagement. Joel chairs the Eugene Human Rights Commission and the Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force. A native of Eugene, he earned a BA in political science at the University of Oregon. I would also like to acknowledge and thank the coordinator for today's program, Mary Layton, for assembling such a great panel. Now, Audrey, we would like to begin with you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for letting me virtually be here today to talk about changes in employment in Oregon due to coronavirus. My name's Audrey Meckling, and I work for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, a think tank that does in-depth research on economic, tax, and budget issues. And our goal is to improve decision-making and create more opportunities for Oregonians. Before I start, I do just want to take a moment to recognize that while I'm here to talk about the coronavirus and resulting economic crisis, we are at the same time living through another crisis that predates our health emergency, namely the murder of Black and brown people in this country at the hands of the police. The same racist structures that create vast economic disparities by race and ethnicity also lead to state violence being wielded against people of color. At the Oregon Center for Public Policy, we stand with Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. And I just felt it was important to recognize this moment before we began. So another thing that I also feel is important to recognize is that I'm here to talk about changes in employment, but I also need to acknowledge my privileged position in this sector as one of those workers who is able to carry out my work from here at my home, while so many others are forced to risk their health in order to work or have lost their jobs entirely. As I'm sure all of you know, in recent weeks, coronavirus has completely changed the lay of the land of employment in Oregon. So I'm here to share four things that we know about employment today and to kind of shed light and highlight one of the things that we really don't know yet. So coronavirus has massively shifted the ground we stand on, and it has been the goal of the Oregon Center for Public Policy to quickly understand this new and shifting landscape and what it means for those people who are really struggling to get by. So the first thing that we really know about employment today is that for many Oregonians, the crisis didn't begin with coronavirus. A huge share of Oregonians have been trying to get by on low wages for years. In December of last year, I authored a report showing who exactly the minimum wage workforce is in Oregon, and it paints a picture that defies stereotypes. At the time, we estimated that over 400,000 Oregonians worked in minimum or close to minimum wage jobs and would be directly impacted by Oregon's gradually increasing minimum wage. Most of those workers, over 90%, are adults. One in four have children that they're supporting on these wages. Most are women, and a disproportionate amount are people of color. A minimum wage worker working full-time in Eugene makes less than $1,950 a month. That's clearly far too little to afford the basics, food, rent, transportation, etc. So before coronavirus even made headlines, a lot of families, beyond even just those earning the minimum wage, were skating on thin ice economically. A new study from the Federal Reserve last year showed that over 40% of Americans can't afford an emergency $400 expense. So in short, the coronavirus crisis hit our country at a time of already widespread economic insecurity. Which brings me to the second thing that we know about employment today. And that's that those low-wage jobs that I was just talking about have been decimated. We are living in a historic moment where unemployment has skyrocketed almost overnight. As I'm sure you know, in the last couple of months, Oregon has seen unprecedented numbers of people filing for unemployment insurance. Over 400,000 Oregonians have applied for unemployment insurance just since March 15th. And those layoffs have been concentrated in the lowest paying jobs. Oregon has also recently begun processing claims for many workers who were previously left out of the unemployment insurance program, those who are self-employed or independent contractors. So we're still seeing those claims come in. Nationally, we are seeing the same story play out. Unemployment claims went from an average of about 200,000 claims per week, that was in January, to a peak of nearly 7 million claims in a single week in that last week of March. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics jobs report, job losses in April alone totaled over 20 million. And unemployment rose to 14.7%. That's a staggering figure. That unemployment rate broke two different records. It is both the highest unemployment rate and the largest one-month increase in unemployment going all the way back to 1948, which is when the measure for unemployment was created. So even more startling is that these figures are likely already out of date and severely undercounting actual unemployment due to the prevalence of temporary layoffs. So this is a problem created by how we actually measure unemployment in the United States. So we don't consider someone to be unemployed unless they're actively looking for another job. And actively looking for another job is a task that's pretty difficult in the midst of a pandemic. The figure is likely a severe undercount. And to put that in context, the best estimate of the unemployment rate during the Great Depression, which took place before the unemployment measure actually existed, is about 25%. And so speaking about unemployment insurance, the third thing that we really know is that even though we have a poorly maintained unemployment insurance system, we are incredibly lucky to have it, and we should be thanking our lucky stars that it exists. And that's because, unlike the one-time stimulus checks that some of us received from the federal government, unemployment insurance offers weekly benefits to those that have lost their jobs. And that stable source of income allows people to continue paying their bills, making their rent, and put food on their table. Without unemployment insurance, we would be seeing many, many more Oregonians falling behind on their rent payments, relying on food banks, or simply going without. That is why it's so crucial that our Senator Ron Wyden was able to secure huge improvements to the unemployment insurance system in the last federal aid package. By expanding unemployment insurance to workers who were previously left out, so once again, the self-employed, gig workers, independent contractors, and the like, and by boosting the weekly benefit by $600, Congress helped ensure that workers would be supported throughout this crisis. Unfortunately, over the decades, we have really failed to properly maintain our unemployment insurance system. Because just like our bridges and roads can fail when we don't maintain them, so it is with unemployment insurance. The Oregon Employment Department is having to rely on very old computer systems, even from the 80s and 90s, to process these claims. As a result, this critical resource is taking weeks to actually get to Oregonians. So the Oregon Employment Department has been overwhelmed by the volume of claims, and some 200,000 Oregonians are still waiting for their very first check. And while they are waiting, their bills are still coming and their rent is still adding up. So all of that is to say there are some huge flaws with the system, but the system is functioning for more than 200,000 unemployed workers. So in a sense, the economic suffering of Oregonians would be twice as bad without unemployment insurance. To put this in context, right now, if we measured unemployment insurance by dollars paid out, it would be the largest paying subsector of the Oregon economy. Unemployment insurance, as flawed as it is one of the main engines keeping our economy running. And that brings me to the fourth thing that we know about employment in the coronavirus era, and that's one of the major flaws of unemployment insurance, which is that it leaves a lot of people out, most notably immigrants who lack legal status. So undocumented immigrants do not qualify for unemployment insurance in Oregon, even though their employers often contribute to the unemployment insurance system on their behalf. So by one estimate, some $270 million has flowed to Oregon's unemployment insurance system due to the labor of undocumented workers. Because undocumented workers are excluded from the unemployment insurance system, they are at a much greater economic risk when they lose their jobs. This also means that for many of these immigrant workers, their lives are at greater risk. Just last week, there was a large new outbreak of coronavirus among the larger Latino workforce at a local berry farm. And unlike workers with legal status who could quit their jobs over safety concerns and collect unemployment, undocumented workers at this business had to choose between risking their lives to put food on our tables and being able to put food on their own. It's a really huge problem. And that really brings me to something that I want to talk about most of all, which is what we don't know about employment and the effects of coronavirus. While state and national figures give us a sense of the scope of this economic crisis, there is so much that we do not yet know about who exactly is being most impacted. I want to illustrate this point with an example. Last month, the Oregonian ran an article titled, "Coronavirus Layoffs Hit All Ethnic and Racial Groups." The article makes use of a recent Employment Department report that analyzes the demographic breakdown of unemployment insurance claims. And that report claims that while low-wage workers have been hit hard by job losses, quote, the impacts are spread more evenly across ethnic and racial groups. Now, this statement may well be true. And based on the Employment Department report, it appears to be true. But based on data that we're seeing nationally and the quality of the data that we have available, I'm afraid it's currently impossible for us to actually know if it's true. So I want to walk through this a bit more and explain why that is. Nationally, there have been really clear disparities in who has been most impacted by COVID-19-related layoffs. A Pew Research Center survey found that over 40% of Hispanic adults in the United States have or live with someone who has lost their job due to coronavirus. That is 17 percentage points higher than for white Americans. This finding also makes sense, as the industry hardest hit both nationally and here in Oregon is accommodations and food services. So that's the industry that includes most restaurants. This industry has a long history of employing people of color at disproportionate rates because Black and brown workers have long historically been relegated to low-paying service jobs. And in Oregon, the accommodation and food services industry makes up over a third of all unemployment claims. This industry has far and away been the hardest hit by the virus. This industry also disproportionately employs Black and brown Oregonians. So about 35% of workers in food services and accommodations are people of color, while only 25% of Oregon's population is people of color. So all of this means is that it is possible that Oregon is an exception to the national trend of layoffs hitting Latino communities hardest. It is possible that despite Black and brown Oregonians' outsized representation in the accommodations and food services industry that makes up over a third of unemployment claims wouldn't result in similarly disproportionate levels of layoffs of Black and brown Oregonians. Like, that's possible. It is possible that for reasons that aren't currently clear, Black and brown Oregonians really haven't been hardest hit by layoffs. However, it is also possible that the reason we are seeing unemployment claims in Oregon mirror the race and ethnic background of the labor force is because of low quality data and barriers that exist to Black and brown Oregonians filing unemployment claims. Reporting demographic data on unemployment claims is optional. And in Oregon, 1 in 5 filers did not disclose their race. So 20% of people who filed unemployment insurance claims did not include their race. This leads to deep uncertainty about the accuracy of these conclusions, as respondents of color may be more likely to not report given the national conversation around race and immigration status. Further, as I mentioned earlier, immigrant workers who lack legal status don't qualify for unemployment insurance at all, and therefore are completely not included in this data at all. And there are even more barriers. For example, the online unemployment application is only available in English. And if you want to apply in another language, you have to call to get a translator. But as I'm sure a lot of you have heard, the Employment Department's phone lines are completely jammed. So because of these language barriers, a lot of workers of color are probably not able to actually apply. Many workers who don't speak English may not even know they are eligible for unemployment insurance in the first place. So all of this is to say, there's some doubt and there's a lot of uncertainty around who is actually being impacted the most by these layoffs. And while we are living in a state of crisis, it makes sense why we are seeking concrete answers to questions. Uncertainty has become a much larger part of our daily lives than we may be comfortable with. I know I personally am not comfortable with it. However, despite our drive for clarity, we are still at a stage of this economic crisis where there are many more questions than there are answers. So let me conclude by saying this. While it may be months or possibly years before we have concrete data available to tell us precisely who this economic crisis is hitting hardest, the crisis has reinforced what was already clear before the pandemic. Economic insecurity is widespread among working families. And that insecurity flows from jobs that don't pay enough, from public structures that we have left to wither, and from persistent racist structures that continue to suppress and exclude our neighbors of color. So my hope going forward is that all of the suffering of Oregon working families becomes a catalyst for change, a catalyst for a more economically just, more secure future for everyone. So now I'm going to turn it over to Ira Cuello Martinez, who I absolutely love, and I'm so excited to learn from. He knows much more about what's actually happening in the day-to-day lives of these workers that I've been talking about.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ira Cuello Martinez. I am a community organizer with VOS Workers' Rights Education Project. VOS is a workers' rights and immigrants' rights organization located in Portland, Oregon. It's existed since the mid-1990s, and it was created out of the streets. Folks at VOS serve the day laborer and immigrant community, which I will explain a little bit more in detail briefly. But first, I want to talk about the history of VOS and how it came from being into community members in the streets to having an actual center here in the Central East Side District of Portland, Oregon. So VOS was first created to combat a lot of the immigration detentions that were happening in the mid-1990s. Folks had to organize themselves on the streets and form systems of communication in order to prevent their community members from being detained and deported eventually from Portland. And they were not committing any crimes. They were on the streets looking for work. They were looking for work opportunities. Due to their immigration status, they didn't have the easy route of going to apply for a job. Rather, they would take any job that would come on site. However, they were very conscious about the different types of jobs, analyzing the risk levels that exist with certain jobs, specifically within roofing and construction and demolition and working with asbestos. There's a lot of risks, safety concerns that exist when one is approached to be hired. And so that began in the 1990s, and we were able to successfully defend our community and build a more a unified community within the day labor community. And after that, there were several years advocating to having a worker center created, which opened up in 2008. So about 10 years after folks began organizing themselves. Prior to that, everything was done either on the streets, churches, or any community center that would open up their space for folks to come in and talk about issues that they're facing on their day-to-day lives. So let me explain a little bit about what a day laborer is, because it's not a very common term, and I know a lot of folks don't know, have never heard about it. So a day laborer is someone who looks for work opportunities on a day-to-day basis. They could be hanging out on the street corner. Another popular spot is outside of home improvement stores like Home Depot or Lowe's. Sometimes you'll find them at gas stations and kind of a hub for folks to wait and find different opportunities to work. Folks don't have any other opportunity to find employment. And as Audrey was mentioning early, minimum wage is just not a very good wage or salary to maintain survival, especially for folks who don't have health insurance, folks who don't have any other kind of benefits from the government. Food stamps, unemployment, like these resources do not exist for the day labor community. And so they often have to think about how much they are earning from the work opportunities that they receive at the street corners or at the center or at the gas station or at the home improvement stores and weigh in the risk that comes with it. And so folks are often thinking about, you know, $15 an hour, I can do that for 8 hours, sure, and that'll help me get by for at least a couple of days. And folks have to be really conscious about how they use their finances, where they receive their food, and just how to navigate through a system where they are barely learning about. It's in a language that they don't know, and it's just a whole new country that they're trying to navigate through. And so day labor communities show a lot of resilience within each other, within the community, and continue to survive just with the very basic knowledge that they have. And they're survivors. That's what they are. They survive the cruel system that we live in that is unjust and unfair for immigrants who might not have that documentation status in order to successfully thrive in this country. And so that's a little bit about day laborers. And as I mentioned, in 2008, we were able to open up a worker center here in Portland, Oregon, thanks to the city of Portland and a lot of community advocacy to raise up this issue and get people off the streets and instead into a center where they're able to more safely communicate with employers and get a better understanding about the type of jobs that they're getting themselves into. Oftentimes it's difficult for day laborers to report to OSHA or other agencies that deal with labor issues due to the fear of their documentation status. There's just not a lot of trust within the government. And so oftentimes they do have to take a risk, and they don't have any follow-up if they do end up getting injured on the job. They don't have any safety barriers to protect themselves. And so oftentimes it's just by word of mouth, letting some folks know, hey, that employer came a couple weeks ago, he took someone to go a roofing job, someone got injured, or they don't have the proper safety equipment to help, or they expect too much of you, or they don't pay you enough. And so oftentimes they communicate with each other about the different employers that come in through the corners or through the worker center. So everyone has a sense of idea of the different types of jobs that they're getting themselves into. And so they really become self-resilient and dependent upon themselves to really analyze what is going on, the types of jobs that they're getting themselves into. And so what kind of jobs do they work in? Well, it varies. There's a lot of specialties within the day labor community, and there's also just general labor. Some of the most common jobs are moving jobs, helping folks move from one house to another, or from one story to another, and often requires two workers in order to uplift, a shelf or a table or a bed or whatever the case may be. Other jobs is landscaping, roofing, demolition, general waste management and cleanup, painting. Some folks do know how to weld. Some folks are more specialized and do pressure washing, and there's just a variety of general labor specialties within the day labor community. And that's something that they always want to highlight, is that they are skilled laborers, often working for lower wages. Oftentimes you will see a painter, charge up to like $40 to $50 an hour, whereas a day laborer, they have to accept $18, $15, $20, and it's just not enough and not comparable to what these folks should be paid for. But again, due to their documentation status and lack of work authorization, they have to accept these lower wages. And it's a very a serious issue that oftentimes day laborers have to face on a day-to-day basis. And sometimes they may not know where the next food source may come from. They may not know when the next work opportunity may come. And so when they see an opportunity, they will go ahead and take it, knowing that the risk, there is a lot of risk going into that job, because they have no other choice. They have no other choice but to take the job that comes and hope for the best. Because at the end of the day, we all have to put food in our mouths, clothes on our back, and a roof over our head. And sometimes it's difficult to even maintain those three basic necessities within our community. So day laborers also, it's really awesome because through their center, they are able to organize and identify what kind of wage is the minimum wage for day laborers for the worker center, which is actually higher than a minimum wage in the state of Oregon and in the city of Portland, because they recognize $12.50 is not enough to survive. It's not enough to get that food on their table. And so this last year, they're able to raise their minimum wage from $15 an hour to $17 an hour. So any kind of work opportunity that comes to our center, they have to pay at least $17 an hour for a minimum of 4 hours of work. So that's guaranteed $67 of work that they would receive if they were assigned a job from the worker center. And that's something that they recognize is important in order to maintain the specialties that these folks carry, because oftentimes folks want to bargain or negotiate for lower wages just because they want cheap labor and want the work to get done and fast. And day laborers are very aware of that, and they want to offset the balance, the unbalance that exists within their own labor and the labor of those who have the credentials here in the United States to you know, be charging these $40, $50, $60 an hour for a similar, if not sometimes not as adequate labor as day laborers often have. Yeah, and during another aspect to know about day laborers is this is very seasonal work. In the winter, things get cold here in Oregon. It gets really wet, and there's a lot less opportunities to do jobs that often are outside or require, you know, better weather conditions. And so in the winter, they're often, you know, using up the funds that they had through the summer that they earned. But right now during COVID-19, it's even more difficult because the opportunities aren't picking up how it used to. It's springtime now, the sun is coming out, and the weather is getting a lot better, but day laborers aren't getting those work opportunities still. Day laborers are still looking with very limited resources. Unemployment is out of the question. We knew that since before COVID-19, so that was just, you know, not even consideration for these folks. And so what we've done here at Volts Workers' Rights Education Project is really create a mutual aid center to support each other with food distribution, finding those financial resources through external support, connecting folks to housing resources, and making sure everyone knows their rights. At the end of the day, it's their rights that are going to help them survive in this community and continue fighting for more rights, because it's not enough. And so day laborers, we really appreciate the work that they do here in Portland, and we see them, they're visible, and we want to continue uplifting their experiences and their identities here in Portland and throughout the state of Oregon, and obviously throughout the country. All right, so I know I've talked about the worker center, day laborers looking for work opportunities and just how they survive on a day-to-day basis. And the different impacts that COVID-19 has had on day laborers. But something else I also want to mention about the worker center here in Portland is just the sense of community that exists and comes with being a member of VOLS. Folks don't just see this as a worker center where they, you know, come look for jobs, although that is the primary reason why a lot of people go. They also see it as a community center where they're able to connect with other folks who have either recently migrated, have been here for several years, up to decades, and just really connect with each other, share different resources. I know sometimes folks love playing chess. It's a really cool to see them just wait there at this space, being able to play chess, watch TV, play music. Some people practice their guitars and singing. And just so there's a lot of community that also exists within VOLS that I have not seen in many other spots in throughout the state. And so when you don't have any other family members, when your family members are still in their home countries, you know, that VOLS is that community that they can go to where they can, you know, relax, spend some time, kind of get distracted from the real world. Oftentimes, you know, these folks are, you know, thinking about how are they going to pay for rent? How are they going to find their next food? How are they going to, you know, cover this medical expense that they just, it's not possible for them. And so oftentimes they like to distract themselves. I'm going to the worker center. We often hold community events. For instance, the Day of Immigrants is in December. I forgot the date, but it's in December. And oftentimes we have like a potluck or some sort of food, some music happening in the background, and just people having a good time. And so that's what VOLS is really about, is about the community that exists and trying to envision a world that they see themselves fit. Obviously, the economic conditions in their home country or the political conditions or the social conditions in their home countries has forced them to migrate into this country to find these opportunities, just to find out that it's also difficult to navigate through here. And there's a lot of barriers. The language barrier is one of the biggest ones, and trying to understand the systems here. And so for them, being able to look for work in the day, you know, and know like, okay, well, $17 an hour is going to be able to pay for my food for at least this week. And so they're aware of that. And then also continuing to learn. It's a never ending learning experience for VOS members. I mean, we do have some very amazing folks. We have some artists who has just draw some beautiful paintings, and I wish I could show you some, because it's amazing how they learn skills just from attending our workshops here at VOS, and then building on those skills and continuing to practice and having access to resources that they didn't have before. And now that they do have it at VOS, or just find opportunities, they want to continue learning and continue building and expanding. And so it's awesome to see how our center just operates as a opportunity to look for work in a safe and comfortable environment, but also build a community that they wouldn't find anywhere else in this city, especially given the demographics in Portland. It's, you know, it's not a lot of folks who look like them. And so when they can go somewhere where they can look, they see other folks that look like them and speak their language, well, obviously they're going to feel a lot more comfortable. But I appreciate the time that everyone has given me to talk about both the day laborers and the community that exists here. And I hope if you have any other questions or if you want to learn more, feel free to visit our. So thank you so much. Now I'm going to turn it over to Margarita Sandoval, who's going to be talking a little bit more about domestic workers. And Joel Iboa is going to help interpret the next section due to Margarita will be speaking in Spanish. And so I hope you get to enjoy what she gets to share over the next 10 to 15 years.
Mi nombre es Margarita Sandoval. Trabajo para la comunidad. Soy voluntaria para la comunidad muy activa. Empecé en el teatro con un grupo de mujeres haciendo los monólogos de la vagina.
My name is Margarita. I'm a community activist, and I've been pretty active in the community for quite a long time.
De ahí, como los monólogos de la vagina, se trata de violencia doméstica. Por azares del destino, me llevó a la YWC, que es una organización que se encarga de ayudar a las mujeres que sufren de violencia doméstica.
So I got my start in the vagina monologues and eventually got connected with YWCA, which, you know, really helps out with a lot of folks with domestic violence cases.
En el cual estoy en un proyecto, the Safe Choice Proyecto, como promotora.
So I currently am still with them, organizing with them as a promotora, as a public health worker, as a community health worker, in a program called Safe Choice.
También estoy en Nacional Domestic Workers, la Alianza, donde ayudamos a las mujeres a las trabajadoras domésticas.
I'm also part of an organizer with the National Domestic Workers Coalition. So we help domestic workers across the state and across the country with their rights.
Bueno, lo más importante, en este tiempo de pandemia, a nivel nacional es un caos. La gente está desubicada, no tiene dinero para la renta, están...
So first things first, you know, right now during the pandemic, it's a complete disaster. You know, people are freaking out. Folks don't have money for rent.
Para renta, para comida, psicológicamente están mal porque no saben qué hacer.
Also food and just in general, right? Like food, rent, but just psychologically speaking, a lot of folks are really suffering now because they just don't know what to do.
Y nuestra comunidad aquí en Portland está... desubicada, sufren de no saber qué darles a los hijos, de comer, cómo pagar sus biles, su renta.
So folks here in Portland, you know, are just besides themselves. You know, they're really disoriented. They don't know how to pay rent. They don't know how to feed their children. They don't know what tomorrow's going to bring.
Por ejemplo, hay una señora que el día de ayer me estaba llorando. Porque decía que le dolía ver a su hija tan insegura cuando ella tiene una beca para estudiar.
So yesterday a woman was speaking to me, and she was crying, and she was explaining to me how her daughter is upset and is concerned. She currently has a scholarship to go study at a university.
Y por ejemplo, ella es trabajadora doméstica. Al venirse la pandemia, ella dejó de trabajar porque muchos lugares en casas no quisieron que fueran a limpiar por el miedo a algún contagio.
And, you know, recently this woman has lost her job. She's a domestic worker in hotels, and right now a lot of hotels aren't hiring domestic workers, or aren't hiring cleaners because of the pandemic, and right, there's people just, they're not going to hotels as often, so labor is not needed.
Y por ejemplo, hay muchas de la comunidad de inmigrante que trabaja en un McDonald's, en un Burger King, en un Taco Bell, donde ganan el mínimo.
There's a lot of folks that there's a lot of folks that work, you know, minimum wage jobs. They work at Taco Bell, they work at McDonald's.
Esa gente gana el mínimo. Esa gente no le alcanza para la renta. ¿Qué tienen que hacer? Ir a limpiar oficinas en las tardes o en las tardes o las noches, buscar alguna casa para trabajar.
So a lot of these minimum wage workers who work at McDonald's or Taco Bell, you know, the money they make in their day jobs just isn't enough. So many of these folks work afternoon jobs or work at strange hours in order to supplement their income, you know, cleaning houses, cleaning offices, or wherever else they can get a domestic work to supplement the income they make at a McDonald's or, you know, a Taco Bell.
Toda esa gente está mal porque no tienen ningún beneficio tanto en un McDonald's como en alguna casa.
A lot of these folks are right now are you know, are panicking and are frustrated because they don't have any sort of public assistance or public benefits. You know, they don't have insurance from a Taco Bell or McDonald's. They don't have insurance from their job in which they're perhaps cleaning an office or a home.
Y la mayoría de los inmigrantes no saben ni dónde ir a pedir ayuda porque por lo regular es a la gente que tiene papeles.
And a lot of these folks don't, you know, don't know where to go. Like they don't know whether eligible or not eligible. The majority of them are undocumented folks, and they're afraid to ask, afraid to.
Mucha de esa gente está a punto de irse a la calle porque no tienen ya para pagar. Muchos de los que renta, de las compañías, la verdad, aunque haya una ley ahorita que los proteja, esa gente no tienen piedad.
A lot of the folks that I'm talking about right now are at the point of losing their homes. You know, they're unable to pay their rent. And although there's a law right now that, you know, stops people from evicting folks during this time, you know, it's my belief that these folks don't care. That they want their rent and they're willing to kick people out if they're not going to pay it.
He trabajado tanto en Portland como en Vancouver con la comunidad y la verdad están necesitan, o sea, un mínimo no les alcanza y en esta pandemia están, son la comunidad más vulnerable.
You know, the folks that I've worked with are in Portland and in Vancouver. A lot of these minimum wage workers before the pandemic hit weren't making ends meet. And now after the pandemic, they're definitely not, they're not making ends meet. And I believe they're the most vulnerable right now.
Trabajo con muchas mujeres, con madres solteras, y se truenan los dedos literalmente porque no tienen para darle de comer a sus hijos.
A lot of the women that I work with, all the families I work with are women, single mothers, you know, and they'll just sit there and they'll pop their fingers or they'll wring their hands because they don't know how they're going to feed their children.
Hay muchos, por ejemplo, hay muchos bancos de comida, sí, pero hay veces que la comida o está un poco caducada, no es comida apropiada para los bebés, para los niños pequeños. Entonces es mucho estrés para la pobre población.
So right now, you know, there are food banks, right? There are people have access to food banks, and sometimes the food's not appropriate. You know, it's not age appropriate, or it's not culturally appropriate. It's not food that they're used to cooking or consuming, and so, you know, it's a really big problem right now, and folks are suffering.
Están tan preocupados por qué va a pasar. Todavía no abren aquí completamente en Portland. No han abierto en Vancouver. No saben qué van a hacer. Buscan trabajo, pero ahorita no pueden trabajar.
There's a lot of confusion and a lot of worry, right? Because Portland and Vancouver haven't completely opened up yet. They don't know when it's going to open up. So people are concerned about what tomorrow brings.
Anteriormente, por lo menos, el mínimo estaban ganando, pero ahorita ni el mínimo, nada. Nadie les da trabajo, no. Es tan preocupante para esa comunidad.
Yeah, before, you know, folks were at least making minimum wage, and they would try to find work and would find work, and they were at least making that. Now, you know, with this pandemic, there is no work. They folks look, but they're unable to find any jobs.
Por ejemplo, aquí en Portland hay mucho, supuestamente hay muchas ayudas. Desgraciadamente, no sé si hay mucha gente o no sé, a la gente que envié a ciertas organizaciones decían, ya no hay.
There's a lot of folks, you know, that there is a lot of organizations that are offering help, but I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's because there's too many people, but the folks that I refer to, certain organizations that are assisting community members, when I hear back from those folks, you know, they let me know that the organizations told them that, you know, hey, we're at capacity. There's no more help.
La verdad, la quisiera encontrar alguna ayuda, no sé, o sea, ves tanta gente tan desesperada en encontrar trabajo, en ayudar, pero hay veces que no sabes qué hacer.
I'd love to help more, and I get frustrated because, you know, people, I want to make sure people are okay. I want to make sure that the families are okay, but, you know, you turn left and you turn right, and, you know, there's nothing there.
Y principalmente cuando hay niños pequeños, cuando no sabes, pues, ¿qué les das? ¿A dónde vas? Les dices, ve acá, ve allá, pero a veces ya no alcanzan las ayudas.
And, you know, especially when families have young children, you know, you tell folks, go here and go there, but by the time they get there, you know, there's nothing there anymore.
Pienso que estamos en una situación para la comunidad de migrante de emergencia, no sé.
I think right now, you know, for the immigrant community here in Oregon, we're in an emergency situation.
Gracias.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Joel Eboa. I am the One Oregon Coalition Manager for CAUSA Oregon.